Whispers from the Dark Season, to Episode 5, The Hypogeum of Hal Saffliene, hosted by Raven Vale. When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. There are places in this world that don't just exist in space. They exist in you, inside your neurons, inside your perception, inside the part of your mind that you think is yours alone, but might not be as isolated as you believe. Places that don't merely surround the body, but enter the mind without permission, without warning, without any way to resist. Places that don't echo, sound the way physics textbooks say they should, but reshape thought in ways neuroscience is only beginning to understand. Places that don't ask you to believe anything, don't require faith or suspension of disbelief, only to experience what happens when you stand inside them and breathe their air and let their frequencies pass through your skull. The Hypogeum of Hal Saffliene is one of those places. And it's not a metaphor. It's not a story about the power of suggestion or the influence of atmosphere. It is a measurable, documented, scientifically verified phenomenon that challenges everything we think we know about ancient humans and their understanding of consciousness. Hidden beneath the streets of modern Malta, under parking lots and apartment buildings, and the ordinary traffic of everyday life, lies a prehistoric underground complex, so precise, so intentional, and so neurologically disturbing that scientists, archaeologists, and neuroscientists from multiple disciplines still struggle to explain it after more than a century of study. It is not a cave formed by nature. It is not a tomb dug in desperation. It is not a temple in the way we understand temples, with altars and priests and rituals we can comfortably categorize. It is something else entirely, something that suggests our ancestors understood the human brain in ways we're only now rediscovering with fMRI machines and EEG monitors and decades of neuroscience research. A structure carved entirely underground more than 5,000 years ago. Not partially underground with some surface elements. Not built into a natural cave. Entirely excavated by hand from solid limestone, level after level, chamber after chamber, with no metal tools, no written plans, no blueprints or architectural drawings, no construction equipment, nothing but stone tools and human determination, and knowledge that came from somewhere we cannot trace. Long before metal tools existed. Long before written language recorded anything. Long before organized religion as we understand it. Long before any civilization we officially recognize as advanced. A place where sound behaves impossibly, violating acoustic principles that should be universal. Where voices travel through stone and return, altered in ways that make no sense. Where human consciousness itself seems to bend, shift, change in ways that are measurable and repeatable and deeply unsettling. This is not legend passed down through generations. This is not folklore or mythology or cultural memory distorted by time. This is measurable science, documented neurology, verified physics, and it's terrifying precisely because it's real. Tonight, on Whispers from the Dark, we descend beneath Malta, into a place that is closed to most of the world, restricted by governments and universities and organizations that understand the implications of what exists there. Into chambers that vibrate at frequencies proven in controlled laboratory conditions to affect the human brain in specific, predictable ways. Into spaces that were engineered, not discovered, engineered for a purpose we're only beginning to understand. This is the story of the Hypogeum of Hol Saphlieni, the underground temple that doesn't just change how you hear, but how you think, how you feel, how you experience reality itself. I'm Raven Vale, and you're listening to Whispers from the Dark. The Hypogeum was not discovered intentionally by archaeologists searching for ancient wonders, or following maps, or investigating legends. It was uncovered in 1902 during routine construction in Paola, Malta. Workers digging foundations for new housing developments, doing ordinary work on an ordinary day, following plans drawn by engineers who had surveyed the site and found nothing unusual, broke through the limestone floor with their picks and shovels. The ground in Malta is limestone. Everyone knows this. Buildings are made from it. Roads are carved through it. It's stable, predictable, easy to work with. Until suddenly it's not. And suddenly, without warning, without any indication, the ground beneath them was anything other than solid rock. The ground gave way beneath them, not collapsing chaotically into an empty void, not falling into a natural cave system like the ones that riddle the Maltese islands, giving way into something carved, something made by human hands thousands of years before, something that should not exist where they were digging, where modern surveyors had seen nothing, where the land appeared solid and undisturbed. What lay beneath was not empty darkness waiting to be filled, not a void to be avoided. It was architecture, deliberate, sophisticated, impossibly precise architecture. Chambers stacked on chambers in three distinct levels, hallways descending into darkness at angles that made no engineering sense, that violated every principle these construction workers knew about building underground. Walls smoothed by human hands with a precision that should have been impossible without metal tools, without electric lighting, without modern measuring instruments. Entire rooms cut from solid stone, rooms large enough to hold dozens of people, excavated entirely underground with nothing but stone implements and time and determination and knowledge that came from somewhere. At first, when archaeologists were called to the site to document what construction workers had accidentally discovered, they believed it was a burial site, a necropolis, a place for the dead. Ancient cultures buried their dead. This is what ancient sites usually are. The evidence seemed to support this comfortable interpretation. Human remains everywhere, scattered through chambers, arranged in alcoves. Thousands of bones representing thousands of individuals across hundreds of years. The assumption was easy, natural. This was where ancient Maltese people brought their dead, case closed. But they were wrong, completely, fundamentally, embarrassingly wrong about what they were looking at. As excavation continued over months and then years, as more chambers were revealed and mapped and studied, it became clear this place was not just for the dead. The architecture was wrong for that. The acoustic properties made no sense for burial. The spatial relationships between chambers suggested something else entirely. This place was designed for the living, for specific experiences, for neurological events that we're only now beginning to understand. The Hypogeum consists of three subterranean levels, carved entirely by hand from solid limestone, not built with stones brought from elsewhere and assembled, carved, excavated, removed ton by ton, bucket by bucket, chip by chip, over generations of continuous work. The upper level dates to around 3600 BCE, making it older than Stonehenge, older than the Egyptian pyramids, older than any civilization we're taught about in school. The lower levels go even deeper into the earth, older and darker, and somehow more refined in their execution. as if the builders improved their technique as they descended, as if they were working toward something specific in the deepest chambers, something that required practice and precision and understanding that accumulated over centuries. No metal tools existed in Malta at this time. Copper was known, but rare. Bronze wouldn't be developed for centuries. Iron was millennia away. Yet the walls show tool marks that are impossibly clean, impossibly precise, impossibly consistent. Stone cut as smoothly as if machines had shaped it. No written plans exist because writing didn't exist. No language we know of was being recorded. No architectural drawings. No blueprints. Yet the chambers align with mathematical precision. Angles are exact. Proportions are consistent. The entire structure follows rules that someone understood and transmitted without ever writing them down. Walls curve instead of standing straight, following organic lines that make no structural sense, but perfect acoustic sense. Doorways are false, carved to look like passages, but leading nowhere. Illusions carved in stone for reasons that become clear only when you understand what this place was actually for. Rooms mirror surface temples, found nowhere else in the ancient world, suggesting knowledge that either spread impossibly fast or emerged from a common source we haven't identified. This was architecture designed not for shelter from weather or protection from enemies, not for storage or living space, or any practical purpose we can easily understand. This was architecture designed for experience, for altering human consciousness through sound and space and frequency. And whoever built it understood something modern science would not rediscover for thousands of years. They understood that the human brain is not a sealed system, that it can be influenced, shaped, altered by external frequencies. That consciousness is not just what happens inside your skull, but is partly determined by the environment around you. At the heart of the Hippogeum, in what archaeologists now call the Oracle Room, though that name implies understanding we don't actually have, something impossible happens. Something that violates what we think we know about how sound works, how stone behaves, how physics operates in enclosed spaces. The chamber appears unremarkable at first glance to modern eyes, roughly circular, about 9 feet in diameter, carved from the same honey-colored limestone as everything else in the complex. No obvious special features that a casual observer would notice. No decorations painted on walls. No carvings suggesting importance. No inscriptions explaining purpose. Nothing to suggest this room is different from any other chamber in the complex. Nothing except what happens when you make sound inside it. Until someone speaks, until a human voice fills the space with vibration, until vocal cords vibrate at the right frequency. Then the room reveals what it was designed to do 5,000 years ago. Then the purpose becomes undeniable. When a male voice resonates at approximately 110 hertz, a specific frequency that falls within the natural range of human speech, but at a particular pitch that requires slight adjustment to produce consistently, requires intention rather than accident, the room comes alive in ways that make trained physicists uncomfortable. Sound does not echo the way it should in a stone chamber of this size and shape, does not simply bounce off walls at predictable angles, does not fade gradually according to the principles we learn in basic physics classes, the laws we think are universal. It travels. It moves through the stone itself, not just bouncing off surfaces, but penetrating into the limestone, setting the entire structure vibrating. The entire chamber vibrates. Not metaphorically, literally. You can feel it in your chest like a second heartbeat, in your bones like electricity, in your teeth like touching live wire. The stone vibrates at a frequency you can measure with instruments, can record with sensors, can verify with scientific equipment. The measurements are consistent, repeatable, undeniable. The air hums with harmonics that appear from nowhere, overtones that shouldn't exist based on the fundamental frequency being produced, additional tones that physics says should not be present but are, frequencies that appear out of thin air or out of the stone itself. The voice returns amplified by the chamber's shape, layered with those impossible harmonics, distorted in ways that suggest intelligent design rather than acoustic accident, transformed into something that sounds less like echo and more like response. As if the chamber itself is speaking back. As if something in the stone, something about the stone, something that exists because of precise angles and curves carved by hands that understood what they were doing, is answering when humans call. But here's the part that moves beyond strange into genuinely unsettling. 110 hertz is not random. It's not a coincidence. It's not an accidental byproduct of the chamber's shape. It corresponds precisely to a frequency that neuroscience has proven stimulates the limbic system, the ancient part of the brain responsible for emotion, memory formation, and subconscious imagery, the part of your brain that operates below conscious thought, the part that generates feeling before you can name what you're feeling. When exposed to sustained 110 hertz frequencies in controlled laboratory conditions, modern test subjects, people with no knowledge of the hypogeum or its history, no expectation of what might happen, report remarkably consistent experiences. Altered perception of time, with minutes feeling like hours or hours passing in what seems like minutes. Vivid mental imagery appearing spontaneously, not consciously created, but erupting fully formed. Emotional flooding, intense feelings with no obvious source. Trance-like states where awareness remains, but identity softens. Loss of bodily awareness. The sensation that physical boundaries have dissolved. In controlled studies using brain imaging technology, subjects exposed to this frequency show decreased activity in the prefrontal cortex, the area responsible for logical thinking, planning, and sense of self, the part of your brain that makes you you, that maintains your identity, that separates you from everything else. That part goes quiet. And at the same time, activity increases in regions associated with emotion, sensory processing, and memory formation. In other words, the hypogeum turns thinking off and turns experiencing on. It shifts consciousness from analytical to receptive, from separate to connected, from individual to something else. And it does this mechanically through physics and biology. Not through belief or suggestion or cultural conditioning. You don't have to believe anything for it to work. You just have to stand in the chamber and let the frequency enter your body. This was not accidental. This cannot be dismissed as coincidence. The hypogeum is a machine, not a metaphorical machine, an actual machine. A resonance engine carved from stone with the same intentionality that we build particle accelerators and MRI scanners. A device designed to produce specific neurological effects through acoustic stimulation. The walls are angled with mathematical precision to channel sound in specific directions. The ceilings are curved to focus acoustic energy at specific points. The chambers are proportioned with ratios that appear repeatedly throughout the structure. Ratios that maximize resonance at that critical frequency. Sound moves through the structure intentionally, not randomly. Channeled through some passages, blocked by others, redirected around corners, amplified in certain chambers, dampened in others. Every aspect of the design serves the acoustic function. Whoever built this place understood something fundamental. They understood that sound is not just something you hear with your ears, not just vibrations in air that your brain interprets as noise or music or speech. Sound is something that moves you at the cellular level, something that passes through flesh and bone and brain tissue, something that changes chemical processes, alters electrical activity, rewrites internal states. This was not religion as belief in unprovable claims. This was religion as neurological technology, as applied neuroscience, as deliberate manipulation of consciousness through understood physical principles. They didn't need to know the biochemistry of neurotransmitters, or the anatomy of the limbic system, or the physics of wave propagation through biological tissue. They knew that when you stand in this chamber and voices reach this frequency, something happens to human awareness, and they built an entire underground complex to make that happen reliably, repeatedly, generation after generation. During excavation that began in 1902 and continued for years, archaeologists uncovered the remains of over 7,000 individuals scattered throughout the complex. 7,000 human beings whose bones ended up in these chambers over centuries of use. Men, women, children, all ages, all sizes, all brought here for reasons we're still trying to understand. Their bones were found deliberately arranged, not piled like garbage, not dumped like the aftermath of disease or war, not scattered randomly by time and decay. Placed, positioned, organized with obvious intentionality, skulls grouped together in specific chambers, long bones arranged in patterns, bodies positioned carefully, sometimes curled in fetal positions, sometimes extended, sometimes in configurations that don't match any burial tradition we know of. Some remains were coated in red ochre, a mineral pigment made from iron oxide. Red ochre appears in ritual contexts worldwide, across cultures that had no contact with each other, associated with blood, with life force, with rebirth, with transition between states, the color of life painted on the dead, or perhaps on the changed, on those who underwent whatever transformation this place was designed to produce. But something crucial was missing from these thousands of remains. There were no signs of violent death, no trauma to bones, no evidence of sacrifice or murder or warfare, no indication of disease outbreak or famine or any catastrophe that would produce mass death. These people were not killed. They were not brought here in crisis. This was not a burial ground created out of necessity or emergency. It was a place people were brought to deliberately, over centuries, for specific purposes. And possibly, probably, a place they were changed. Not killed, changed. The dead might have been placed here after whatever transformation occurred. Or perhaps the transformation itself was the point, and death was simply what happened to some who underwent the process. We don't know. We can't know. But the evidence suggests this was not about ending life. It was about altering consciousness, and sometimes perhaps that alteration was permanent. One of the most famous artifacts discovered in the Hippodrome during early excavation is a small limestone figurine, now housed in the National Museum of Archaeology in Valletta. She's known officially as the Sleeping Lady, though early archaeologists mistakenly called her the Fat Lady, unable to see past their own cultural assumptions about bodies and beauty. She lies on her side on what appears to be a couch or platform. Her eyes are closed, her posture is relaxed. She is clearly not dead. She is sleeping, or perhaps not sleeping. Perhaps something else, dreaming, trancing, experiencing something between waking and sleeping that our language doesn't have a precise word for. This figurine appears nowhere else in Mediterranean archaeology. The pose is unique, the symbolism is unique. This was not a culture obsessed with death the way we often interpret ancient burial practices. This was a culture obsessed with transition, with sleep and dream and trance and altered awareness, with states of consciousness that exist between categories, between alive and dead, between awake and asleep, between individual and collective, between human and something else. The hypogeum was not about endings. It was about crossing thresholds, about moving between states, about experiencing what exists on the other side of normal waking consciousness. The sleeping lady is not a memorial to the dead. She's an instruction, a map, a representation of what this place was designed to induce. Even today, in the 21st century, with electric lighting that eliminates natural darkness and climate control systems that regulate temperature and humidity, and regulated visitor access that limits exposure and prevents prolonged contact, people report intense reactions inside the hypogeum. These are not ancient superstitions passed down through generations, not medieval folklore embellished over centuries. These are modern experiences documented by tour guides who've worked there for decades, archaeologists who spend months studying the site, maintenance workers who enter the chambers daily, and tourists from around the world who come expecting a historical site, expecting to take pictures and learn some facts and move on with their vacation, and instead encounter something else entirely. Something they weren't prepared for. Something that stays with them. Dizziness that starts suddenly, with no warning, no gradual onset that you could prepare for. One moment you're fine, walking normally, thinking clearly. The next moment, the floor seems unstable. Disorientation, where walls seem to shift when you're not looking directly at them, where distances become uncertain, where the straight hallway you just walked through somehow seems longer or shorter or curved in ways it shouldn't be. Sudden emotional surges that hit like physical impacts. People starting to cry for no reason they can identify. Tears streaming down their faces while their minds search desperately for explanation. Or feeling overwhelming joy that makes no sense given the context. Or terror that comes from nowhere, from nothing visible or logical. Or connection to something vast and incomprehensible. Or loss that feels personal, even though nothing has been lost. Emotions that flood through them without any trigger they can name, without any thought or memory or stimulus that would explain the intensity. A pervasive feeling of being watched by something that has no eyes, no body, no physical form, but is nonetheless present and aware and paying attention. Not paranoia. Not imagination. A certainty that something notices when you enter, tracks your movement through chambers, observes your reactions, remembers that you were here. Multiple visitors report this independently, using nearly identical language, despite having no contact with each other, despite coming from different cultures with different frameworks for understanding experience. Some visitors experience spontaneous visions, not imagination, not daydreaming, images that appear in their minds, fully formed, detailed, vivid, more real than memory, not like something consciously created, but like memory of things they never personally experienced, scenes from other times, faces they don't recognize but feel they should know, ceremonies they never witnessed, but can describe in disturbing detail. Others feel panic, an overwhelming urge to escape that overrides everything else, claustrophobia in spaces that are actually quite large and well ventilated, a primal need to return to the surface that overrides rational thought, that makes them abandon the tour and rush toward exits, gasping for air that isn't actually thin, escaping danger that isn't actually present. Many report the same strange sensation, described in almost identical language, despite having no contact with each other, despite being separated by months or years of visits, that the structure is aware of them, not alive in the biological sense, not haunted in the supernatural sense, but aware, responsive, present, noticing, that something in the stone or about the stone or because of how the stone is shaped, notices when humans enter and responds to presence in ways that are subtle but unmistakable if you pay attention. Because the hippogeum doesn't behave like a ruin. Ruins are dead things, finished things, artifacts of what was. The hippogeum behaves like a system that still functions, like a machine that was never turned off, only paused, waiting for the right conditions to activate again. The hippogeum is one of the most restricted archaeological sites on Earth. This is not normal museum practice. This is not standard cultural heritage protection. This is not how most ancient sites are managed. This is something else, something that suggests officials understand more than they publicly acknowledge. This is a place you cannot simply visit whenever you want, cannot show up at the door and purchase a ticket, cannot experience on impulse or convenience. Only a limited number of people are allowed entry per day. 10 people per hour maximum, 80 people maximum in a full day. No exceptions for wealth or status or academic credentials. No special access for researchers beyond what's already been granted through lengthy approval processes. No overnight stays for experiments, no matter how important the research questions. No prolonged exposure for any reason, regardless of scientific value. Access must be booked months in advance through the National Heritage Organization, sometimes a year in advance for popular periods, sometimes longer. You plan your entire trip to Malta around a single one-hour slot that might be available 6 months from now. You cannot bring recording equipment beyond basic cameras for personal photos. Absolutely no audio recording devices allowed under any circumstances. No sound level meters. No frequency analyzers. No acoustic measurement equipment. No sound experiments permitted under any circumstances, no matter how non-invasive, no matter how carefully designed, no matter what institution backs the research. No attempts to reproduce the frequencies that make the oracle room resonate. No extended stays in any single chamber beyond what the tour group allows. Tour groups move through quickly, efficiently, shepherded by guides who have learned through experience not to linger in certain areas, not to let groups gather in specific chambers, not to allow the kind of sustained exposure that might produce the effects the structure was designed to create. Officially, publicly, in all documentation and explanations given to visitors and journalists and researchers, these restrictions exist solely to preserve the structure. The limestone is fragile, damaged by even slight increases in humidity. Carbon dioxide from human breath increases acidity in the air, accelerating deterioration of carved surfaces. Moisture from bodies, from breath, from the simple presence of humans, damages the walls over time. Foot traffic, even careful foot traffic, erodes the floors millimeter by millimeter. All of this is true. All of these concerns are legitimate. Conservators worldwide would agree these are valid reasons for limiting access. But they don't explain everything. They don't explain the specific restrictions on sound recording or acoustic research that have nothing to do with conservation. They don't explain why proposals to study the resonance properties with modern equipment, proposals that would involve no physical contact with the structure, are consistently denied, despite coming from prestigious institutions. They don't explain the nervousness of officials when pressed about the neurological effects, the way conversations get redirected or terminated when researchers ask too many questions about what happens to people's brains inside the Oracle Room. Unofficially, and this is not conspiracy theory but observable pattern, no one wants to answer why prolonged exposure causes measurable neurological effects in ways that are difficult to explain and harder to control, because acknowledging that openly would mean admitting something terrifying that undermines comfortable assumptions about history and human development. It would mean admitting that ancient humans understood consciousness better than we do, that they had knowledge we've lost, that our technological civilization, with all its brain scanners and pharmaceutical interventions and theories of mind, is rediscovering things that people with stone tools somehow already knew. The builders of the Hippogeum left no written language, because writing as we understand it didn't exist yet. No inscriptions carved into walls, no cuneiform or hieroglyphs, or any early attempt at recording language. No names of kings or priests or architects, no dedications to gods or explanations of purpose, no instructions for use, no mythology explaining what this place was for. Nothing, only the structure itself, only the shape of the space, only what the stone does to sound and what sound does to consciousness. But they left precision, mathematical precision, that can be measured with modern instruments. They left acoustics so exact that audio engineers study them and cannot improve on the design. They left neuroarchitecture, spaces shaped specifically to produce neurological effects in ways we're only beginning to understand with fMRI machines and years of study. This was not primitive. This cannot be dismissed as the work of simple people doing the best they could with limited knowledge. This was advanced in a way we still don't fully understand, in a way that suggests knowledge that came from somewhere and then vanished, leaving only this structure as evidence it ever existed. Which raises an uncomfortable question that archaeologists don't like to address directly. If this knowledge existed once, existed 5,000 years ago in a culture that left no written records and no obvious precursors, where did it come from? And more importantly, where did it go? Why don't we see this understanding developing gradually, improving over centuries, spreading to other cultures? Instead, it appears fully formed, functions perfectly for a time, then disappears as if it never existed, leaving only this single example carved in stone beneath Malta. And why does similar knowledge keep resurfacing in other places, other times, other cultures with no apparent connection to each other? As if something keeps trying to re-establish itself, keeps pushing through into human awareness, keeps building these places that alter consciousness, only to be lost again when civilization collapses or priorities shift or the knowledge gets suppressed or simply forgotten. The Hippogeum is not alone. It's not an isolated anomaly that we can dismiss as coincidence or lucky accident. Similar resonance chambers, designed with similar acoustic precision, built to produce similar neurological effects, exist around the world in cultures that had no contact with each other, no way to share information, no common source we can identify. Newgrange in Ireland, older than the pyramids, with a chamber that produces standing waves at specific frequencies. Chavín de Huántar in Peru, with stone corridors that channel sound in ways that trigger altered states. Egyptian pyramid chambers with acoustic properties that modern architects still study and struggle to replicate. Göbekli Tepe, in Turkey, even older than any of these, with evidence of ritual activity focused on sound and trance. All pre-written history, all acoustically precise, all designed specifically for altered states of consciousness. This was not coincidence. This cannot be explained by parallel development or convergent evolution of ideas. This suggests a global knowledge, an understanding that existed across continents, across cultures, across time periods that were taught had no contact. A lost science of consciousness that appears and disappears throughout human history, leaving structures like the hypogeum as evidence that it existed, that it worked, that ancient humans knew something we've forgotten. So what was the hypogeum really for? What was its actual purpose beyond the simple labels we apply, like burial site or temple or ritual space? It was not a tomb, because tombs are passive. It was not a temple, because temples worship what is believed, not what is known. It was a threshold, a specific, engineered, precisely designed threshold, a place where sound and stone and human biology intersected in ways that produced predictable, repeatable results. A place where people went deliberately to experience something beyond ordinary awareness, something that changed them, something that could not be accessed any other way. Whether you call it spiritual awakening, or communion with the divine, or possession by forces beyond understanding, or neurological manipulation through acoustic stimulation, depends entirely on your worldview, on what frameworks you're willing to accept, on what makes you comfortable. But one thing is undeniable regardless of what language you use to describe it. The hypogeum changes people. Changed them 5,000 years ago. Changes them today. Will change them as long as the structure exists and frequencies can still resonate through stone carved with knowledge we've lost. Today, in the early 21st century, the hypogeum is quiet, controlled, restricted, watched by authorities who understand what it represents and what questions it raises. Tours are carefully managed, access is limited, sound is minimized, voices are kept low. The oracle room is not used for its original purpose. The frequencies that make it resonate are not deliberately produced. It sits there beneath Malta like a sleeping system, its potential contained but not eliminated. But silence doesn't mean inactivity, doesn't mean the machine is broken or the system has shut down. The stone still vibrates when the right frequency passes through it. The chambers still resonate when sound reaches them at the correct pitch. The frequencies still exist, still work, still produce their effects on human neurology. Physics doesn't change. Biology doesn't forget. The hypogeum still does what it was designed to do. It's just waiting. Waiting for voices to reach the right tone. Waiting for someone to understand what it is and use it intentionally. Waiting in darkness beneath the modern world, patient in ways that stone can be patient, in ways that human lifetimes cannot measure. The hypogeum of Hal Saflieni is not a mystery because it is old. Age alone doesn't make something mysterious. We have plenty of old things we understand perfectly well. It is a mystery because it still works, because it proves something we're uncomfortable acknowledging, because it demonstrates that ancient humans understood something fundamental about consciousness, something about the relationship between environment and mind, something about the malleability of awareness and the power of sound to reshape thought, something we are only now beginning to rediscover after centuries of assuming we knew better, after dismissing everything that came before as primitive and superstitious and ignorant. It proves that sound shapes reality, not metaphorically, but literally, by changing how brains process information, how consciousness organizes itself, how identity forms and dissolves. It proves that environment alters thought in ways that are measurable and repeatable and can be engineered. It proves that the mind is not confined to the skull, not a sealed system protected from outside influence, but something that can be opened, reshaped, redirected by external forces if you understand the principles and build the right structures. The Hypogeum was not built to house gods that may or may not exist. It was built to change humans, to alter consciousness, to provide access to states of awareness that ordinary life doesn't permit, to cross thresholds that normally remain closed, and perhaps, almost certainly, it still does. Still changes people, still alters consciousness, still provides access to something beyond the ordinary. The system was never turned off. It was only forgotten, only restricted, only limited in how it's used. I'm Raven Vale, and this has been Whispers from the Dark, Season 2, Episode 5. Some places don't whisper stories about what happened long ago. They whisper instructions for what's still possible. And once you hear them, once you stand in spaces designed to change consciousness, once you feel frequencies pass through your skull and alter how you think, you are never quite the same. The threshold has been crossed, and there's no way back to who you were before you understood what ancient humans knew, that consciousness is not fixed, that awareness can be reshaped, that we are not as separate, not as individual, not as protected as we believe. The stone remembers, and it's still listening.